This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Week 5, Cherry.
Yay,
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Coming up today, public toilets.
All
they
right.
are hard to find in this country, but why? Journalist Jen Miller joins us to talk about the history of restrooms and new approaches in places like Philadelphia. You can join the conversation if you've got toilet takes.
Ooh.
Email them to studio2@whyy.org. You can tweet at WHYY, hashtag Studio2, or you can call us, as always, 888-477-9499.
And a little later, Billie Holiday's final performance is reimagined in Lady Day. We get to listen to Holiday's unmistakable voice and talk with the jazz artist who is located right here about taking on this important role. Looking forward to that. But first, Avi, something we expected is now official.
6 a.m. this morning, before we all woke up, or at least before I woke up, Delaware's own President Joe Biden officially announced his reelection bid.
The question we're facing is whether in the years ahead we have more freedom or less freedom, more rights or fewer. I know what I want the answer to be, and I think you do too. This is not a time to be complacent. That's why I'm running for reelection.
Not unexpected, right, Cherry?
Yeah.
But Joe Biden is officially in the race, which means Delaware, and in many ways, Pennsylvania will be back in the spotlight in 2024.
Yeah. And at age 80, of course, we all know President Biden is the oldest person serving as president in U.S. history. And if reelected, he would reset that record and end his second term at age 86.
Yeah. And it's interesting to read and to hear the messaging in these announcements and kind of figure out where are these campaigns positioning themselves. He mentions MAGA extremists.
Yeah.
And there are pictures of other politicians, not just President Trump, if you look at the video. But MAGA obviously was based on Trump's initial campaign slogan. And it does seem like this is all set up to kind of assume that his opponent will again be former President Donald Trump. And I wonder if that calculation will bear out.
Yeah, we shall see. Of course, Biden is not expected to face any serious Democratic contenders this time around. So, you know, we'll see if that holds out. And so let's move on to the next story on our list.
Sure.
Right here again in Pennsylvania. A House committee has passed an election reform bill that would allow early tabulation of mail-in ballots and give voters a chance to correct some ballot mistakes. The only problem is it is unlikely to pass the state Senate. Now, you know, there has been a major problem that led to all kinds of speculation about, you know, voter tabulation. And it's because election officials cannot open the ballot envelopes. They can't unfold them until 7 a.m. on election day. But this bill would allow that to happen about 7 days before election day. It would also they would change the deadline for applying for mail-in ballots from the current 7 days to 11 days. And it'll do a few other things to make mail-in balloting more accessible. But it's Democrat supported. But again, Republicans in the Senate could stand in the way.
We're going to say that about a lot of bills this year and next year. Going to get by one house, not going to get by the other house. Of course, this issue of tabulating ballots, pre-canvassing ballots, has been completely politicized because of the 2020 election. And frankly, I don't think it's biased to say because of Donald Trump's focus on election fraud and election conspiracies has made these types of things, which, by the way, exist in some Republican-controlled states.
Yeah.
They already have these rules. They passed them before the 2020 election, but have made things like this basically impossible to get done, even though a lot of the people on the ground who work in elections, both Republican and Democrat, believe these ideas are good ideas.
And it would make counting ballots, mail-in ballots, faster, which is would cut down on speculation because you would know sooner who the winners are. And speaking of this whole election fraud.
Yes.
Let's talk about Tucker Carlson real quickly.
That's a spicy transition. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tucker Carlson, if you guys probably know at this point, he and Fox News parted ways yesterday. And there's a sort of an amusing local connection because
you always find him.
Yeah. So the last segment that he ended up doing last week was very clearly not a I know I'm going to get fired segment. Like, it wasn't like, I thank you all for listening. I thank you all for being here. It's been such an honor.
He thought he was coming back.
He thought he was coming back. And the segment itself was an interview with a pizza delivery driver from Delaware County. They were eating pizza together because this guy, Tyler Morrell, had gone viral in Delaware County for tripping a suspected thief, allowing the police to apprehend the guy. It was caught on like a Ring camera. Yeah. And so this guy, Tyler Morrell, now forever in history, Delaware County's own Tyler Morrell, will forever be the last guest on this landmark cable news show, which is just sort of odd.
Philly against everybody. We always in it, right?
Somehow.
And so we're going to move on to our newsmaker segment. Joining us today is Alan Dom. He is a real estate developer and former Philadelphia City Council member at large. Now he is running in the Democratic primary for the mayoral election happening, in just about 3 weeks. Alan Dom, welcome to Studio 2.
And thank you, Avi, for having me.
So let's start here. You've put a lot of focus on your first 100 days as mayor. Pick out a couple of things from your first 100-day plan that you think you can get done in those first 100 days that can move the needle for people.
Sure. Day one, I would declare a crime emergency in the city, a public health emergency in Kensington. I do have a comprehensive plan on my website, votedom.com. But also I would declare, I've already formed it, a public safety cabinet, that I would have weekly meetings consisting of the police commissioner, district attorney, FBI offices, attorney general offices, ATF, U.S. attorney, courts, Septim Paco security, Eds and Med security. We would have these meetings weekly with the goal to reduce homicides by 50% in the first 4 years. The goal is to get retail theft under control and also to prosecute illegal gun violations. That's really an issue, the gun violence in the city. And I think we can make it happen. And for Kensington, I can just briefly speak about that. I put a resolution in when I was on council back in, I think it was March of 22. And that was to, after talking to Governor Wolf, that was to, look at Kensington. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. I wanted to declare it a FEMA site. It's worse than a hurricane, flood, or tornado. Called Governor Wolf. He thought it was creative, but no place in the government yet, but told me to put in a resolution. I did it. It called for three things. One, federal, state, and local drug and law enforcement working together with community partners on the ground like NKCD to have a plan to shut down the drug dealing, help those people that are addicted into treatment, and rebuild Kensington Avenue, Lehigh to Allegheny, 2-3 blocks on each side to get it back in business.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about that. Specifically, you've been talking about dealing with illegal guns, and just sort of dealing with a lot of the public nuisance issues. I want you to get in specifically, how will you do this? And you even talked about stop and frisk even. How will you do this without rolling back all the criminal justice reforms that so many people worked hard for?
Right. Well, I think I'm not rolling them back. I think what we're trying to find is a middle ground where we have accountability. About 8-9 years ago, our crime was less than half what it is today. And I've actually had a lot of great ideas and suggestions and advice from former police commissioners and law enforcement people across the country because I recognize they're a lot smarter than I am in this area, and I want to reach out to them for their help. And this is a team effort. One person, one mayor isn't the smartest person in the room. You have to reach out to other people. But I will say this. We know, like other cities, that the crime is being committed by a very small amount of people. In the city of Philadelphia, we believe it's about 1,800 people are involved in the violent crime, mostly gangs, mostly drugs. Unfortunately, some of it is retaliation. We also know that the retail theft, like in the core of the city, in 2022, 70% of the retail theft was committed by less than 30 people. Think about that. On March 17th in Macy's at 13th and Market, someone was arrested for the 67th time for shoplifting. So it's the same people committing the crimes. We need to get that under control.
You have been a proponent of lowering certain types of taxes, both on council and I believe still now, including a wage business taxes. You've also proposed boosting spending on some core city services. You want to keep rec centers and libraries open 7 days a week. Help me do some math here. How do you cut taxes? And I know you're supposed to spur growth eventually with that, but in the near term, how do you cut taxes and expand core city services?
So, our budget in 2015 was about $4 billion. Today it's $6 billion. It went up 50% in 8 years. $2 billion. $2 billion. And I can't sit here today and say our city services in 2023 are better than they were in 2015. So there's plenty of money there. And I found a lot of money when I was on council. There's ways to make ourselves more efficient. Look, we wasted a ton of money on the Enquirer building. We lost over $80 million on selling 46 in market. We waste a lot of money. There's plenty of money that we need. Better management is what this is about, and better leadership.
That is something you hear from politicians a lot, that you just got to find the efficiencies. And yet somehow we still find ourselves in this cycle of the next politician saying, right, I'm going to find the inefficiencies and iron them out. Can you just dive in a little bit? I mean,
sure.
I'm talking about, where can you find a big chunk of money?
Well, I'll give you, past experiences.
Okay.
But, the best way to go is what I've done in the past. When I ran for council in 2015, our collection rate for real estate taxes was 89%. That 11%, the majority, were landlords who didn't live in Philadelphia. Many lived in New York, who owed us 3, 5, 10 years of real estate taxes. I worked with our revenue commissioner. We came up with a program called sequestration, where we sequester the rents of the delinquent landlords. So we sent a tenant a letter that says, "Dear Alan, on May 1st, your landlord owes us 3, 5, 10 years of taxes. Send your rent to the city of Philadelphia." Mm-hmm. What a hammer. We went from an 89% collection rate in 15. In 2019, before the pandemic, our collection rate was 96%. We collected about $120, $125 million more. Then, I think it was 2017, I called up the finance department and said, "Hey, we're not assessing commercial properties correctly." I don't blame anybody, because the skill set of assessing a building like WHYY or other mm-hmm. buildings is a different skill set than a row home. I suggest we go outside and get a commercial appraisal firm, which we did. It cost us a couple $100,000. We found another $125 million we weren't assessing.
And there's a lot more low-hanging fruit like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I got to ask you, I mean, you're talking money here. You've been called the condo king.
I don't call myself that, though.
Yeah, people, I said you've been called, and you own a lot of property in the city. You've become, very well off living in Philadelphia. And that wealth has allowed you to pump millions into your own campaign. So I wanted you to talk to the people who may be struggling in North Philly, West Philly, wherever. Why should they believe that this is about anything other than Alan Dom, you're running for mayor, and that you'll do something to actually help them? Why should they believe that?
Well, most of my friends say to me, "You're out of your mind, okay? Why would you want to do this? I came here with nothing. I came here in 76 making $15,000 a year. Philadelphia was unbelievably good to me. I invested in the city, and the city invested in me. And I was fortunate, and all I want to do is give back to the city I love. I have to walk away from everything that I own, okay, to do this. But I'm guided by a quote from Winston Churchill, who says, we make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give. And for me, at this point in my career, all I want to do is help our city really achieve and provide so much more opportunity for people in North Philadelphia. We have the worst, you talk about taxes, we have some of the lowest paying jobs, of the highest percentage of any city in the country. Like in the last 10 years, jobs under 35,000, we produced at 60%. National average was 29. We're not doing a good job in getting people out of poverty, not making them comfortable in poverty, taking them out of poverty.
But we do have to leave it there. Alan Dom, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Dom is a former city council member at large and running for mayor in the Democratic primary. Coming up on Studio 2, Cherry, we have a hard shift here. We're talking about public restrooms, the history and the politics of public restrooms. And we want to know what you think about this topic, because it's starting to heat up here in Philadelphia. If you have a comment on toilets, 888-477-9499 is the number to call. That's 888-477-9499. Or you can email us, studio2@whyy.org. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And thank you for listening to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Guess what we're talking about today, Avi?
I already know the answer.
Toilets. Now, let me tell you, it's not something that we typically think about until we really, really need to go. And then when we need a toilet, they're hard to find. In the U.S., we have roughly 8 public toilets per 100,000 people, which means we often rely on the kindness of a store or restaurant owner when we're out and about. It also means a lot of people have no access to bathrooms. But believe it or not, it wasn't always this way, Avi. The U.S. used to invest a lot in restrooms. I didn't know that.
And we might be investing again. We shall see. Here in Philadelphia, we are installing 6 new public toilets. They're called Portland Loos. That's the type of toilet it is. The first one will be right by City Hall. And journalist Jen Miller wrote a recent article in the New York Times about these new outdoor bathrooms and why public facilities like this are so rare in the U.S. Jen Miller, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me on to talk about toilets.
Yay!
You're the expert.
I am.
So as strange as all this sounds, if you have any questions about the history or politics of public toilets or why we stopped investing in this infrastructure, you can email us, studio2@whyy.org. You can tweet at WHYY using that hashtag, Studio 2, or you can call us, 888-477-9499.
And so, Jen, we're going to jump right into the toilet right now. And I want to talk about this new pilot program with the Portland Loo and what makes it so cool and why it's so groundbreaking when we zoom out and look at it.
Well, it was designed by the city of Portland, Oregon, and they ended up basically letting another company manufacture them because they worked so well in the city of Portland, which does have a large unhoused population. And I used one when I was in Charleston, South Carolina, and they're ADA accessible. You can bring a caregiver in. They're made out of stainless steel. They're very hard to vandalize. Mm. It's not that I tried to, but I was in there and I was thinking about how I might be able to vandalize. And it's possible, but it's not so easy as if, you know, you're in the bathroom in 30th Street Station. They use blue light to discourage people from using drugs in there because it's harder to find a vein. And they are designed to be useful, but you don't want to hang out in there. Like, there's vents.
They're purposefully uncomfortable.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that you can do your business and then get on with your business, whatever that may be.
So let's backtrack a little bit.
Okay.
The Portland Loo is all the rage today, but there's a long history of public restrooms in this country. Take us back. Let's start with the colonial times. I mean, there were public restrooms all the way back when Philadelphia was just a baby city, right?
Everywhere. They were everywhere. There was a communal octagonal toilet up against basically like the wall of Independence Hall next to the room where it's happened, if I'm sure our listeners know what Hamilton is. Yeah. And it was communal. And you could have gone to the bathroom next to George Washington. And there were no partitions. It was just, you know, like a Roman bath. That's where the tradition came from. And there were privies all over the city. And if you go to Independence Hall and you go to where Ben Franklin's house was, there's actually one that has not been capped. Now, there's nothing down there that would stink, but it's there's an enclosure over it so you can look down into what the privy was. And it would not be unusual for, let's say, if you were walking up Market Street, which at the time was called High Street, going down to the courthouse and, oh, I have to go to the bathroom, to duck into any privy that you could find because it was just – there was no sense of privacy, as the museum curator at Independence Hall told me. So if you want, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was curious. So then they seemed like they went away and then they came back and then they went away again. So take us through that zigzag.
So Philadelphia in colonial times smelled horrible because there was just open defecation still. The privies stank. There were, unfortunately, like dead animals in the street. Everything smelled really bad. They were wearing layers of wool in July and August, which I cannot imagine. And then in the 1850s, in 1854, a scientist in England named John Snow identified how pathogens were passed. It wasn't just quote-unquote bad air. It was through infected feces or contaminated water. So there was this idea of cleanliness, the need for sanitation. It was also the Victorian era where people got less used to sharing, let's say. A lot of shame, a lot of thoughts about bodies. So the idea of a private toilet, water closet, single stall, outhouses became more common. And then with the temperance movement, there was this idea, well, if we give men a place to go to the bathroom that is not in a bar, they won't drink anymore.
So they came back again.
It came back again, yes.
Yeah. And then they went away again. What happened there?
Partly it was that the toilets built were expensive to maintain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of them were underground, which were inaccessible, obviously, to a lot of people. And then you get into the 1960s and the 1970s when city budgets dried up. One of the first things to go was sanitation, cleanliness, and then public bathrooms got a bad reputation, and then people treated them poorly, and it was sort of the self-fulfilling prophecy. that toilets would be disgusting.
Yeah, I want to jump in here because, you know, I mean, we're at a point now in the country where we're talking gender neutral bathrooms and public restrooms. But let's talk about the history of women being able to use public restrooms, because you talk about urinals and things.
Yes.
Those are not something most women can use. And so talk about that. Because
sure.
Was it harder for women to have access to bathrooms?
Well,
and how did that evolve?
Women didn't leave their houses as much, partly because if you were menstruating or you're pregnant, you had to hide away. And women obviously weren't in the workforce as much as we are now. And then department stores started creating very lovely bathrooms so that middle-income and upper-class women would come in to use their bathrooms. The other thing was, at a time when you had chamber pots, I don't think I need to explain what those were. Mm-hmm. It actually turns out that women's underwear at the time was not like underwear that we typically wear today, so they could just hold the pot up to them without having to unwrangle themselves because there was
a lot of clothing.
Yeah, but their smalls and, or whatever you want to call them, knickers, were open at the crotch. Mm. Sorry, Mom. but it's true. It's just it was easier for them to go to the bathroom in privacy.
Right. And I want to also talk about the public health aspect of bathrooms, because you touched on it. There was this realization that it was you could actually create a healthier society if you had access to public bathrooms. And you think about it, was that not a consideration as public restroom money started to dry up?
Well, Leslie Lowe has a great book called No Place to Go where she discusses this. It's just that we still have a lot of Victorian tenants where we don't want to talk about this stuff. Mm. And she said that the only reason we're really talking about it now is talking about period equity and that everybody should have access to menstrual hygienic products. And the other thing is that the private sector did somewhat step in. So someone like me, who's, you know, took a shower this morning, is housed, could step into just about any private business and use the restroom. So once the public sector started to step in and provide bathrooms, it sort of gave municipalities a cop out to say, well, we don't have to do it because, you know, you could just go to the, you know, you could go to the Barnes & Noble in Rittenhouse Square.
Starbucks.
Yeah.
Which no longer is there. And the new Barnes & Noble will not have public restrooms. So
yes.
so we're in a bind.
Yeah. So let's talk about the bind. There are very few public restrooms available right now, even in a very dense part of Philadelphia. Why do we need them? What does this help solve?
Well, it allows a lot of people to be full members of society. You think about folks who need to use the bathroom more often, women, especially pregnant women, people who menstruate, the elderly, anybody who has an inflammatory bowel syndrome like Crohn's or colitis. You know, we want people to be full members of society. You think about caregivers who might be able to find a bathroom, but they got to, you know, take toddlers down a bunch of stairs to get somewhere. And that's just, that might not be feasible. So we want everyone to be a full member of society. And we want people who are unhoused to have dignity and have a place to go to the bathroom, because if there's nowhere for them to go to the bathroom, it doesn't mean that they stop going. And also, you know, there's issues with still spreads of diseases. We had a hepatitis A outbreak in Philadelphia, and many states have had hepatitis A outbreaks, I believe 37, if I'm remembering correctly off the top of my head. And nobody wants that. So, you know, we should fix this. We should do something about this.
Yeah, and if you are just joining us, we're talking with Jen Miller, a freelance reporter who has written extensively about the issue of public restrooms and a whole host of other subjects. I want to pivot a little bit and talk about the issue of public restrooms in other countries. And before I do that, I want to bring in a caller, Elaine from Mount Airy. Elaine, welcome. What's your comment?
In Paris, France, 10 years ago, and there were public restrooms all over. They were like little igloos, enough for one person. They did not charge any money. And when you exited the restroom, there was an automatic something or other that cleaned the whole restroom with water, hot water and everything, up and down. And it was really marvelous. And when I wasn't near one of those, I found I could use my school of French and go into any restaurant and say, I'm a tourist. I need to use the restroom. Here's a pound. Here's a franc. And they never took money, and they always let me in. I don't know if that could be happening in Philly.
Thank you, Elaine. And Elaine is talking about Paris, bathrooms in Paris, in case you didn't hear that part. But I want to zoom out and piggyback on Elaine's comment. What has been going on in other countries when it comes to public bathrooms?
Well, it is still common in other countries, especially in Europe, to have paid bathrooms. And that is not a thing we do here anymore in the U.S., which started out for a good reason. It's that that going to the bathroom was a human being seen as a human right. And they often charged for stalls but not urinals, and that was seen as very sexist. And there was a movement to end the practice of paid toilets in the United States for the benefit of everybody. And cities ended up, a lot of them agreeing, and removed bathrooms altogether instead of making them free. In Europe, it's different, although they've been having their own challenges. A lot of restrooms closed during the pandemic and have not reopened. There's a scheme in the city of London and a section of London where businesses are given a small stipend and a marketing. They're part of a marketing campaign if somebody can come in and use their bathroom while they're open. There's a, you know, and also in Paris during the exhibitions of the 1800s, I off the top of my head, I don't remember what the year was, like when they built the Eiffel Tower, they installed urinals everywhere, public urinals. And even though that was only urinals, it still gave this idea that, you know, people are coming to Paris, we want them to be able to use the bathroom. So it's a combination of their traditions and also that there are paid options there.
When governments do build public restrooms that are free and open, and it goes wrong, what typically goes wrong? Because you mentioned there used to be a decent infrastructure in this country, and they got the reputation, I guess, of being unsanitary, unsafe. So before I guess we can talk about solutions, what goes wrong when things go wrong? Money.
It's money.
It's investment.
Yeah. And I'll talk about San Francisco here, which is a pit stop program where they there were children in the Tenderloin District, and a bunch of council people, I believe, met with them and said, what can we do for you? And they said, we don't want to walk around poop on the way to school. And the city invested a lot of money in creating the pit stop program, which is more than 30 toilets. They are staffed. They are not open unless they are staffed. So some of them have two attendants. Some of them are open 24 hours a day. To, you know, people can use the restrooms, and there's safe needle disposal. There's sanitation there. But there's a person there to make sure that if something happens, and I believe some of them carry Narcan, if something happens, that a person is there to say, hey, you know, they get a knock, you know, what's going on in there? Are you okay? But that costs more than $12 million a year. And to get a city over the hump to say, we want to invest $12 million a year, and most of that cost is the attendance, it's just, there's a lot of city governments that won't do it.
And there's a lot of competing interests, a lot of other things to spend money on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I want to piggyback on Avi's point here, because I recall a few years ago, the Kensington neighborhood, they added public toilets to help keep the community clean. There have been some issues there. And they had a Hep A outbreak and all of that. But then on the very first day that the public toilets and you know, hand washing stations were set up, they were vandalized.
It's because we tend to think that bathrooms aren't worth taking care of. It's just because if they've been like if they've been so disgusting, it's just this, again, a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't know why that happened.
You mentioned that the Portland Loo, which is now being installed here in Philadelphia, was hard to vandalize. Can you specify? I can't imagine a space that's hard to vandalize. There's so many ways to vandalize.
People find a way.
it's stainless steel, so it's hard to break. There aren't a lot of pieces. So what are you going to break off? A toilet seat? Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of public toilets. There's one at the dog park I go to a lot that doesn't have a toilet seat. It's just a bowl. And if you know, I spoke to, I believe it was the city of Vancouver, Washington, where they had a brick public toilet, and in 20 years, the building had to be torn down. Just because it was brick, people would knock on the bricks. It just was easy. And they are bringing in Portland Loos because they think that they will last for longer than 20 years. It's not that they're indestructible. They're just harder to destruct. And the doors lock, but you can see if a person is in there. Like, there's that much venting in it, too.
Interesting.
Yeah, and Jen Miller is a freelance reporter whose work often appears in Philadelphia Inquirer, New York Times, and more, and she's written about public restrooms. We have a comment from Jackie who says, the new Portland Loos, what about safety and needles, especially in Philadelphia where there is a high rate of substance use disorder? Can you talk about that and piggyback on what Avi was just talking about?
Well, they use blue light, so it is harder to find a vein.
You mentioned that, yeah.
Sorry, I just blanked there. Yeah. So they're designed, again, to be temporary.
Right.
And the other thing is, if people are using bathrooms to meet addiction needs, is it the bathroom's fault? Is it the person's fault? Mm. That doesn't solve, you know, they have to go somewhere. And I know that there's a lot of controversy about safe injection sites in Philadelphia.
Right.
Well, if a bathroom is their only option, where else are they going to go?
Let me ask about solutions that might not involve building new restrooms. Because if you walk around Center City, you could throw a stone and hit a building with a bunch of restrooms in it. They're just privately owned. Is there a way to incentivize private business to perhaps open up restrooms and maybe cover the cost of damage? I mean, I don't know exactly how those partnerships would work, but it does seem kind of a shame to be building so many things and staffing so many things when already there are toilets that exist.
Sure. There are, I believe in Singapore, if you are a business, and if I'm misremembering, I apologize to the World Toilet Organization, who I interviewed for this story, that if you have a first floor bathroom and you're a business, it is open to the public. That's it. That's the rule. They have a different culture around toilets in that country. So the gentleman told me, who's in charge of this organization, that they don't have the same issues with vandalism. Also, there are harsher crimes and penalties in Singapore in general.
Yeah.
We could legislate that. If you are a business, you have to have your bathroom open to the public. The furthest we've gotten in some states, if you are a person who has Crohn's, colitis, incontinence in general, a business is required to let you use the bathroom. Now, that's not nationwide. And also, if a person working that day doesn't believe you, because like you're surprised about this, but this is a thing in that community that's well known, they might not let you in.
Interesting.
I have an email from Tiffany who says, I am someone who has a bit of a phobia about public toilets, mainly because they are usually unkept, and I don't like sharing a bathroom with hundreds of people during the course of a day. However, I also feel they are so very necessary and that we need better facilities in this country, particularly. How do we sort of change people's perceptions?
Yeah, change the narrative.
You know, because, you know, that was one of my sayings, like, you're so used to them being gross and problematic, but they're trying to change this. How do you change perception?
Well, I'll tell you from the past. In the 1920s, when cars became all the rage and more affordable, and there were more of them, and more people decided to go on road trips, different than today, but still, and women started to come on these road trips, and it wasn't just men. Gas stations started making nicer bathrooms because they were catering to women. They would put advertisements on billboards and in women's magazines about like makeup counters and comfortable couches, not unlike what you would see like in the Cherry Hill Nordstrom, like that level of nice. And once there became a perception that a bathroom should be nice, they got nicer, people treated them better.
And, a virtuous cycle.
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. We have this self-fulfilling prophecy of bathrooms that they're going to be disgusting and people disrespect them. You can do it in the reverse, too. I don't know how we could get public funding for that or governments or change people's minds. Because then you think about what you think of a gas station bathroom now. If a gas station bathroom is seen as the optional last resort, then you might treat it that way.
Absolutely. Well, I hate to flush this conversation, but
we have to
go to our next segment. There's so much to be really. It's amazing how expansive this topic is.
Fascinating.
Jen Miller, thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2. Jen Miller is a freelance reporter whose work often appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer, New York Times, and Washington Post. She's also the author of Running, a memoir, and lives in New Jersey.
Coming up, we're talking jazz.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, do you like jazz?
Like this music right here?
Yes.
I'm not a jazz aficionado, but I mean, no disrespect. I think it's a great art form. I just didn't grow up with it.
It's all good because I love jazz, and Billie Holiday is one of my faves. So I went to see Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill at Suzanne Roberts Theater. It's a reimagining of Billie Holiday's final Philadelphia performance. Audience members, that we sit in this seedy, fictional bar. It's really cool.
Sounds great. And Billie Holiday was born in Philadelphia, so it was a nice connection there.
I know, and I learned that in watching this. And she's known as such a star, but she went through so much. She was sexually assaulted at a young age, and she suffered from severe substance use disorder that led to her death. Lauren Talese plays this version of Billie Holiday, and Lady Day, and the Lady Day performance was just a few months before she died in 1959. She was just 44 years old when she passed away.
Good morning, heartache. Thought we said goodbye last night. I turned and tossed until it seemed you.
think back to her prime. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was so talented, mm-hmm. but also so traumatized. Tell me, how did you, what about her story sort of resonated with you such that you wanted to play this character?
Well, I'm at a place in my life where I feel like it's important to observe without judgment. And as I've, you know, been blessed to have more and more years on this earth, I feel like there's room for grace more than judgment. And I think when you judge things, you kind of just, you exclude yourself from the experience of understanding and perceiving beauty and complexity. And I think that is Billie's story. Yes, she struggled with some things in her life from, you know, as early as, you know, single digits, 7, 8, 9, and 10 years old. And she transcended those things and became a star. Like, we're still talking about her so many, almost 100 years after she was, definitely more than 100 years after she was born. And that's something that is remarkable to me. I think my whole life, I've seen a variety of colorful.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Characters who have experienced things similar to Billie Holiday, including drug abuse, alcoholism, you know, and I think I've been more available to them and more helpful to them if I had to interact up close. When I've been able to take my ego out of it and take my sense of judgment of whatever they're going through out of it and just be available to listen, just be available to absorb what they're telling me without, you know, really taking it on as my own struggle, but being available and vulnerable enough to empathize with and also experience what the joy or the joyfulness of that part of their story could possibly hold.
And I want to talk about your own life. You're from Cleveland. You went to U of Arts here mm-hmm. in Philadelphia. Were there things that you were able to draw from to tell that haunting part, the darker
yes.
side of her story?
Absolutely. I think coming from Cleveland, I did not grow up in any affluent neighborhood by any stretch of the imagination. So being a kid of the 90s, you could imagine some of the things I saw. You know, just a decade prior, crack was a major epidemic, and I saw a lot of people succumb to their addictions to drugs. And then more recently here in Philadelphia, you know, Fishtown is super cool. Everybody's going to hang out at these cool restaurants. But just down the way where I've gotten my eyelashes done, you know, a couple times, there's Kensington. And at any time of day, right now, you could go down there and unfortunately see somebody nodding out because they've used. So I've had a lot of inspiration for this role up close and personal and from a distance. And it made it so that it was readily accessible for me to channel it into this role.
I love your voice.
Thank you so much.
And it has such range and such depth to it. But when you sang as Billie Holiday, you changed your actual voice. Mm-hmm. What did you do to prepare? Because she has a hollowness to it.
Yeah, she does.
And an emotional center. Mm-hmm. How did you change your deep voice to her more hollow voice?
I listened to so much Billie Holiday this whole year. I think it was in December maybe when, you know, this became, you know, an apparent or a possibility for me to do this role. So I immediately started listening to a lot of Billie Holiday because I'm like, I'm going to have to sing her tunes. And I've heard Billie my whole life. And I've always known that she's had that hollowness as you describe it so aptly. And my voice is definitely more round and a little deeper for sure, a little more resonant. And so I just listened to a lot of her and tried to like put a finger on what were some things that I could possibly do to my voice to kind of put you in the mind of Billie without imitating her, because I didn't want to imitate her, and neither did our director, Jeffrey. He was like, this is not a review. This is not a jukebox musical. This is us telling the story through you of Billie Holiday. So he wanted like subtle nods of me in there, but he also wanted to feel Billie's presence. And I worked hard to be able to deliver that. And I said, "Dear doctor, you don't know what's really worrying me. I wanna be somebody's baby doll so I can get my loving all the time. I mean, you can get my loving all the time. Oh."
That laugh, Lauren.
You, I'm always laughing.
That laugh. Oh, my goodness. By the way, that's Baby Doll. It's a Bessie Smith song. Mm-hmm. And Billie Holiday loved Bessie Smith.
Yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that laugh for the second, because you use that laugh as a vehicle for so much.
She's this bold woman who is like, you know, working with all these men in a male-dominated industry. It's still male-dominated even to this day. And she's had all these traumas very early on, but she was never a victim, you know? And that was something that when I was working with Jeffrey Page, he reminded me of, but I saw it. Like, she's telling all these really heavy details about what happened to her. But just like the people you might know in your family, you know, your aunties or uncles or cousins who go through, like, some crazy stuff, when they don't want to be seen as a victim, they kind of laugh at their trauma. It's a trauma response. You're laughing through the pain. And that's something that we really wanted to be clear in this iteration of Lady Day at Emerson Bar and Grill, because she wasn't a victim. She was singing every night. She was fighting men in alleys. She was that chick, you know? She was born in Philly, raised in Baltimore. She wasn't no flower, you know, no delicate flower. Although she did deserve softness and beauty in her life, and I wish she got more of it. But at the same time, somebody like that, we thought, would definitely lean more into laughing through the pain than saying, "Woe is me."
Do you have a favorite Billie Holiday song?
It's the last song, but I won't tell anybody what that is. But the very last song at the end of the play is my very favorite song. To me, it's so emblematic of her life and her journey and, you know, where she was.
And we'll leave it there, Lauren, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful cliffhanger mm-hmm. to come see you perform mm-hmm. as Billie Holiday.
Yes.
Congratulations on a wonderful debut.
Thank you. I received that. Thank you so much.
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do. Ooh, what a little moonlight can do to you. You're in love. Your heart.
I just want to say, I truly, truly enjoyed talking to Lauren.
I could tell.
And I loved the Lady Day performance. You can see it at Suzanne Roberts Theater through April 30th. It was amazing. And that's it. Avi for Studio 2, our producers, thank you so much, are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Diana Martinez.
For more of our show, you can head to whyy.org/studio2. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts as well. Feel free to give us a rating. Studio 2 is from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. She's Cherry Gregg.